We get things underway, though, by welcoming in, as we do each Tuesday afternoon, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. A good afternoon to you, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Mr. Gimble?
Well, I'm going pretty well, because we've got tonight, what is always, as somebody pointed out earlier today, the best two words in sports, Game 7.
Is it the best two words, though? Another championship seems like better two words to me. But yes, Game 7 is certainly enticing. And you have two original six franchises at the new Boston Garden, and the Maple Leafs, of course, with their rabid fan base, whom they very rarely reward, right? Talk about long-suffering fans going all the way back to 1967, the last time they won the Cup. And the Bruins, with their very flinty core of Bergeron and Chara and Marchand and Krejci, looking to do what they normally do to the Leafs in these Game 7s, although it did, of course, get pretty hairy back in 2013, right?
Indeed. But you're not here to talk hockey this afternoon. You have you've spent some time thinking at, studying, analyzing the beast we call Twitter.
Yeah, and I liked it when we were talking about it the other day, because I screwed up. Normally what happens is that I will reach out to Rich over the Facebook Messenger, because it's just handy on my phone, even though I'm not on Facebook, and suggest an idea that we might talk about in the show. And I said to him, oh, we should talk about, and I typed Tinder, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Studying the Tinder. I've been breaking it down. And I was wondering later, it's like, man, what does this guy think that, like, I'm up to? Then they're like, oh, yeah, I see you ladies on the Tinder. I know how best to work what you're going to like. You know, I feel like I need charts, right?
I thought you were going to provide some guidance for people to create the perfect Tinder profile.
All Tinder is basically people writing one-word notes to each other and depressing someone like me by showing that there are actually multiple ways that people can misspell the word hi, which you wouldn't have thought was the thing until you've delved into that world. But I have delved into the world, the cesspool world of Twitter, and I also have some questions, because despite my researches, I do not see the point of this at all. I do not understand how it works. I do not understand what people are seeking here. I do not understand the entire notion of followers, because it seems to me like the most horrific people out there, as well as the most bland, are the people with the most followers. And I wonder how they come by these followers, because I'll see, for instance, people in writing who have never published anything in any venue that anyone ever would have heard of, the Never Heard of It review, and they will be on Tinder, and they'll have 46,000 followers. And it's like, how would you even know that this person exists? Like, their friends and family can bump them up to the lofty 34 that I am at, although none of my friends and family are on there for the most part. But how do you get many thousands of followers through doing what? Who really is that interested anyway in what you have to say, which is never of any sort of ardor? It's not thoughtful. It's not funny. It's just this endless glib fest. And I wonder if what these people are doing is they're spending large chunks of their life on something like Twitter, seeking out followers.
Well, and spending money too, in some cases, to get more followers.
Yeah, I learned about that, but it's like basically signing away your life over swaths of time for what is this sort of fool's errand of life incarnate. Because these followers, look, you can be the ultimate moron, and you can have 100,000 followers. You can be just a trashy, horrible, racist, sexist, whatever, short of a pedophile person, and you're going to have the followers.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the comments for people, you read through them, and it's like, what is this supposed to be? Is this some, like, clever observation? Is this some little, like, are you Pascal and this is your pensée? Like, no. Is this funny? What you do often see is how painfully unfunny most people are. And yet, they're going to say their jokes anyway. It's like when I'm in the Monument and I'm doing my set and I'm going up and down 10 times, there is always some guy at the top who's coming down who is going to say the exact same joke to every person he passes. That joke is going to take one of two forms. He's either going to say, there's a bar waiting for you at the top, yucks, 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 or he's going to say, oh, the elevator's not working. It's like, dude, you just said that to 15 people. Now it's my time. And sometimes when I pass this person multiple times because I'm moving at a brisk clip, he's going to re-joke with me each time. And I thought, you are Monument Twitter, sir. And I didn't say to him that he needed to be put down because I thought that would have crossed the line. But when I look at Twitter, I think, who is this for? Is this for your ego? What are you satiating here with your festival of glibness? And yet it clearly means something to people. And that tells me that they can't tell the difference between something that actually has meaning and something that is totally bereft of the merest ghost of meaning.
Well, now, I like Twitter. And I like Twitter now. Facebook is awful, too. I like Facebook very little. I post pictures of the family, and that's it. I stopped making political posts on there because I wanted to fight people, and that's not my nature. But I like Twitter as a consumer because it allows me to sort of curate my own feed of what I want to see. You pick the people you want to follow. I like that aspect of it. As far as the whole followers game, I have no desire to go there. And part of it, too, is you get followers by following people yourself. So if you want to follow 50,000 people, you might get 40,000 to follow you. But again, who wants to invest that kind of time?
Well, first of all, I don't know that you do, because a lot of these people that I'm seeing, and like that example I gave you of the person who's published something once, they'll follow 125 people, and yet they will have 35,000 followers.
Hmm.
And I can't explain that. It's not like the one thing that they published once was in the Wall Street Journal or whatever it might be. It will be in something that hardly even exists. And then you have this larger problem. You have the places that purport to care about art and entertainment, don't actually care about those things at all, making decisions on whom they will sign up based upon how many Twitter followers they have. The Atlantic is going to make somebody a staff writer because they have 1.1 million Twitter followers. Someone is going to give somebody a book deal because they have a certain number of Twitter followers. And the thinking is, you will be bringing this audience to us. And yet, if you were actually any good at making art or entertaining people, or you just understood what has value in life and what does not have value in life, you would invest very little time in Twitter. So you have basically this idea of the snake swallowing its own tail. And I see when people point to, oh, it's Netflix, it's short attention spans. There are so many other factors that have nothing to do with those things. And this obsession with followers. There's this one particularly odious racist sexist in publishing whose little comeback line to people tells you where this person's head is at is, get some followers. That's like your throwdown kind of, let's whip our knives out and go after each people. It's like, You need some kind of intervention in your life with the people who at least pretend to care about you, that you're not doing this right. This is not a life well-lived. It's not a life in any kind of service to anybody else or even to yourself. And that's what I see encapsulated constantly during my voluminous researches on Twitter, which took me back to Tinder because I was like, ladies, please love me. I'm feeling so low. And they're like, no. You don't have enough followers. God damn it, Gimbal!
And then they ask you, oh, so you're a writer. Do you like, have I read anything you've written? Like, do you do those Chicken Soup for the Soul books?
No, they find out how many followers I have, and then they don't understand, because then they look me up on Google, and they're like, I don't know how it's possible. I don't know how I'm in all the places I'm in, and I have the 34 followers. If anything was going to be kind of an underscoring of the nullity, the hollowness of the Tinder thing, I don't go out and seek it. I just go out and put out into the world what I know other people are not putting out into the world, that has its own inherent value. And I'm not chasing that ambulance. I'm not going after the fire engine like the dog to get these followers. I figure I'm going to reach a point in my life and my career when those people are just going to come to me through whatever makes that happen. But then it'll just be a matter of like, hey, well, you're Bob Dylan. You have to have the account. Do you think Dylan, though, gives like a posterior, though, about like Twitter? Do you think Shakespeare would care? Do you think, right, like George Lucas would have cared if it existed in 1977, even with all that toyetic, massive business stuff going on? it's just a means to an end for those people, whereas for other people, it's the bulk of their identity, and it's not good for you.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. I want to pause for a moment, get away from Twitter and Tinder, and talk ghost stories. And you wrote a wonderful piece in Daily Beast about what might be the only decent ghost story, if not the only ghost story at all, related to Easter from M.R. James. And you had already talked about his great holiday tradition at Christmas of sharing ghost story, but an Easter work as well, A Warning to the Curious.
He did the Easter one, and it makes a certain amount of sense if you think about it, because you're right. There aren't really fictional ghost stories set around Easter time, but you do kind of have the ultimate real-life ghost story, don't you, with the whole Jesus, I'm in the cave. There's a boulder on the mouth of the cave. Let me just pop this bad boy off. I'm out! And then you go up to your old buddies, and they think that you're like this wraith from beyond. You're like, no, I'm here. Go ahead. Put your finger in my hole. See, I was up on that cross. So sort of what M.R. James was doing was he was riffing on this idea of the Trinity. In this ghost story, you have these three crowns that are buried at strategic points in England, and they're meant to fend off attackers. And so this one family takes it as their business to protect one of the crowns. And the young guy is in his 20s, and he's out there protecting it, and he catches the pneumonia. He dies. And this other guy who's on holidays waiting to move to, like, Greenland, he shows up, and he kind of gets the lay of the land from, like, a drunken innkeeper. He learns where this crown is, and he goes and he digs it up. He's like, oh, wow, this is nuts. And he's staying at this, basically a hotel, with these two friends who are there. And he has this figure that's now following him around. So he has a problem. He comes upon the two friends, and he says, I did something I probably shouldn't have done. Do you want to come into my room? I have this ancient crown of England. So they go in. They're like, oh, my goodness. Wow, you actually do. And they set off on this mission to return the crown to this barrow. And there are just these wonderfully evocative, creepy lines of this follower, whatever this creature is. It does something to your eyes, is how it's phrased. So you see things that aren't there, or people that you think are certain people actually aren't, and they might be this creature leading you astray to get you at this sort of vulnerable point. And it is indeed exactly what the title says, a warning against the kind of curiosity that can definitely snuff out, as it were, your life in the end.
And before we let you go, I want to talk about the absolutely wonderful short story. It just blew me away, Dunedin, which is, man, you've written so much great stuff. This one, I don't know. I can't shake it. I keep thinking about it. And you wrote it pretty quickly, as you always do, but it lingers with you. I can tell you that.
It's another kind of, actually, coincidentally, like, biblical play. So Dunedin is the city in Florida where the Toronto Blue Jays have their spring training. And the story is a pun on Dunedin, as in we ain't in Eden anymore. It's a retelling, rejiggering of humanity's fall from Eden, seen through the eyes of a mid-teen who is visiting with his family, his parents' best friend. And he has a brother, this kid's name is Aiden, and he has a brother named Maxwell, who's like 15 months younger. And Maxwell has had a stroke, and the stroke and Maxwell's condition determines where and what the family can kind of do. And this older brother has become his younger brother's protector. He is able to function, but he starts and ends each sentence with the same word. And the older boy has a crush on the daughter of his parents' best friends in Florida. And he wants to go to Florida because he wants to reunite with this person. And she ends up connecting with his younger brother in a way, in a scene that, you know, the scene I'm talking about, mm-hmm. I think is quite different than anything you might see in literature that involves a maze in the basement and a kind of manipulation, not with hands, let's just say. And he basically, what he does is he sets up his brother to take a fall with this girl's own brother. He frames him kind of for a theft. He sells his brother out, whom he's meant to be protecting, and he realizes that he'll never be quite the same person again. He might go on to become a better brother, but that's in part because of the knowledge of what he's done. So it's this kind of fall in the modern era, set in the spring of 1987, which, as you know, if you're a baseball fan, and these kids are baseball fans, was a huge time for home runs in baseball. There was right. like everybody was hitting home runs. So it's very protean. It's meant to be kind of like that Garden of Eden where life is teeming and this young boy is going to make a decision that's going to impact who he becomes later on as an adult.
Well, it really is a tremendous story. And for baseball fans, the homage to Dick Groat is pretty nice, too.
There's a Dick Groat. So Heartland was a toy company, a plastics company.
I wanted to ask you, was that a real award that they gave?
Well, it's a real, so it's a toy. So you know your namesake there, Kimball. You know the story, the first episode of The Fugitive, the old TV show. They go to like a carnival, and one of the prizes you can win is a Louis Aparicio. You can see it. You'd have to know what you were
one of these,
for.
I guess what we would call an action figure, right?
Yeah, it's bigger than an action figure, but they were really artful. The detail was incredible, and there was Warren Spahn, Nellie Fox, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron. And there was this lesser-known baseball player named Dick Groat, and he was a shortstop for the Pirates. He won the MVP in 1960. And this brother at this place in Dunedin, he trades in memorabilia. He's like an enterprising college student. So Dick Groat, because he was not Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays, wasn't hoarded as much by kids. So that statue became super valuable, even in 1987. And this brother, Aiden, ends up stealing it and framing his stroke-ridden brother, Maxwell, with that particular theft. But yeah, it was a real toy, and it's out there. You can look them up on eBay, and they go for so much right now, and the Yogi Berra one's cheap, but the Dick Groat was like the crown jewel, to bring it back to IMR James, of Heartland Plastic Toys.
Check out Colin's work at ColinFlemingLit.com. Don't look for him on Twitter. Bring 50 followers with you to Twitter, and don't waste his time unless you have something good to offer on Tinder.
I'll lead you all into the battle of the revolution, the new time, and the Bruins are going to win tonight.
Excellent. Thanks, Colin. See you next week.
See ya.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.